It really is like an exodus of people. Holy cow. Awesome. Awesome. Well, good morning, everybody. For those of you that I haven't had the chance to get to know a little bit better, my name is Katie. I live in Waterloo in a tiny basement apartment. I'm the founder and executive director of a startup nonprofit, and I'm married to a logical and fit guy named Scott Robertson. During our wedding ceremony, the pastor asked Scott, "What's Katie's favorite thing to do?" And Scott replied, "Eating popcorn." So that's me. That's who I am. But if there was one thing that you should probably know about me, it's that I like conflict. Not kidding, not kidding. So much so that I've trained in peace studies, conflict management and analysis, mediation and facilitation, and develop programs to equip youth with tools they need for healthy conflict resolution. I like conflict because it gives us an opportunity to step into grace, to show up in our important relationships with mercy and love for others. I've experienced my fair share of unhealthy conflict in close relationships. I understand the relational wedges it can drive at home, at work, everywhere. But I've grown to become more comfortable with conflict, and even like it, because conflict is an opportunity for us to grow in our own self-awareness, to understand the people around us better, and to dream up creative solutions for our toughest challenges. With the right tools, we can step into conflict bravely and use those difficult conversations to bring about transformation in our relationships and for ourselves. To help us think about the dynamics of conflict, I have an image to show you taken by Carol Penner. So when I saw this image, I had kind of like a wash of frustration. Like, oh, ah. If this was my hymnal that somebody drew crayon in, I probably wouldn't be that okay with it. My reaction probably wouldn't be very gracious. But after I let that emotion wash over me a little bit, I had a second reaction. This is kind of beautiful. Like the messiness of it, but the vibrancy of it, the color, the expression, it's beautiful. And then, of course, the irony. Grant us, Lord, the grace. When somebody colors in something that they shouldn't, grant us, Lord, the grace. When somebody frustrates you, grant us, Lord, the grace. I'm not a parent, but if I was, I probably would have a hard time disciplining this child just because of the irony of this image. I love it. This is a great example of how conflict can be a beautiful opportunity to practice grace. I do believe that we do need to take responsibility when we've hurt someone or something, but we can respond to someone who has hurt us with grace in a caring and accountable way. When I'm thinking about grace and when I'm talking about grace this morning, I really like the way Rachel Held Evan describes it. She writes, "Christians have a bad habit of letting grace get stuck in our heads. It becomes a doctrine we defend rather than a virtue we exhibit, an idea around which we rally rather than the animating force behind how we live." Grace is meant to be enacted. It's meant to be done. And so that's the way that I'm thinking about grace this morning. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring practical ways that we can transform interpersonal conflict from passive to strengthened relationships. As an introduction this morning, we're going to take a look at the following questions. So, number one, what is conflict? Two, why should we care? And three, what can we do about it? So, what is conflict? We all have our own ideas of what conflict is and what it means. This morning, when we speak about conflict, I'm talking about arguments and disagreements that happen in relatively healthy spaces. Often when we think about conflict, our minds go to the worst possible situations or the most difficult people in our lives. And if we dove in there this morning, it would be like me going to the gym and doing a Scott-level workout. Like, it would be dangerous. I really could get hurt. And I would need to practice to get there and get stronger before I'm ready to be effective and safe at that level. So we're starting off just easing ourselves into this work and into these ideas. In October this year, I was working with a class of grade 5 and 6 students. It was our first day together, and we were just starting to talk about conflict together. One student said, "I don't think conflict can ever be solved." At 11 years old, this young woman already had a defined sense of a few things about conflict. One, conflict is difficult. Two, finding positive solutions to conflict can seem impossible. And three, that without the right tools, conflict becomes this challenging, unsolvable thing that can create harm in our relationships. Already, at such a young age, she had her own narrative about conflict. The story she was telling is that harmful conflict is inevitable, so you might as well brace yourself, guard yourself, not let anybody in. And for years, this was the way that I understood conflict. We should avoid it. The status quo of underlying tension, careful choice of words, and avoiding emotions were to be done at all costs. This was the way that I experienced and engaged in conflict and have done a lot of intentional work to unlearn these patterns, but still sometimes struggle to choose grace. What stories do you tell about conflict? About why it happens, who it happens with, how it feels. The stories we tell about conflict and the way that we understand conflict, that story is valid. That story matters. And the hope that I have for our congregation is that that's not where our story ends. The thing is, conflict isn't always about what we're fighting about. We have different perspectives. We have different ways of doing things. I've become very aware of this in my life, particularly when it comes to the dishwasher. Yeah. At my house, this has been an area of contention, and maybe at yours too. Or maybe it's more about who will be the dishwasher. I don't know. A while ago, Scott came to me and said, "Hey, we need to talk about the dishwasher." Very skillfully and calmly, he said, "This is something that's been bothering me for a long time." Oh, okay. When the dishwasher is full of dirty dishes, can you just turn it on? It really bothers me when the dishwasher is full of dirty dishes. So I, in response, "Oh, of course. Like, no problem. Look at us. Like, talking about stuff, no problem." So I go on in my dish-using life, and a few days later, I know the dishwasher isn't quite full. You know, there's maybe a space for like one or two cups, maybe some cutlery, like it's not quite there yet. And that evening, in a much more emotional conversation, Scott comes to me and says, "What? Like, you did it again? The dishwasher is full, and there are dirty dishes in it. How much longer is this going to go on?" We were missing each other in this conversation. While we both agreed that we should run the dishwasher when it's full, we had different definitions of a full dishwasher. We were working with different information, and our different perspectives created tension, even when we'd had a conversation about it. The second time Scott talked to me, he was a lot more frustrated. There was a lot more emotion behind what he was saying, not because the dishes were dirty, but because I wasn't holding up my end of the bargain. He felt like I didn't hear him and wasn't respecting his request. So sometimes conflicts aren't about what we're fighting about. Sometimes they're about the deeper things that we need. I want to share a framework this morning that helps us understand these needs broadly. You may be familiar with some different frameworks, and this is just another one that helps us understand our needs better. Looking at our needs, it's an opportunity for us to become more self-aware. Is the conflict about the issue, the problem that we're talking about, or is it about something within me that I haven't addressed? Often, our conflicts aren't about the thing that we're fighting about. There are often other things going on for us that make us feel hurt, that drive the emotional tension of conflict. This might be our different opinions, or our values, or our needs. So let's take a look at these needs. When we look at security, we're talking about all of the things that make us feel safe and healthy, so things like food, shelter, water, all of those important things, but also safety, security, maybe financial security, or long-term planning, whatever it is that's making you feel safe, secure. That's definitely a need that we have and addresses a lot of our physical needs. But we have all of these other important needs too. So we have a need for recognition. If you're working really hard at something, if you are putting a lot of time and effort into helping someone or doing a great job on a project, whatever it is, we want to be recognized for that. And sometimes if our work or our skills aren't being recognized, that can be a driver for conflict. Self-determination. We want autonomy. We want to be able to make our own decisions. And if there's a situation where maybe somebody's making a decision for you, that might be a situation where you're more likely to dig your heels in and say, no, I don't want to do it this way. So self-determination is an important piece of thinking about our needs. Meaning, when I work with elementary students and they have a worksheet, the first question they ask, is this going to be marked? They need meaning. They need to understand why they're doing something. They need to understand why it's helpful to them or how it's going to benefit them in some way. And in the same way, we need meaning too. And we need to belong. We need to find spaces where we feel valued, we feel that other people understand us, where we are part of a community. And so if any of these things are kind of out of whack or in a certain situation, you're not feeling something, some of these things, and maybe really underneath the surface, like really subconsciously you're feeling some of these things, it can be a driver for conflict. It's so important to remember that we have these needs. The more we can understand ourselves and our values in relation to these needs, the more we can stay present in conflict and keep arguments from escalating. I don't notice that I'm hungry and angry. I just notice that I'm right. Anybody else feel this way? Anybody? You're shy. That's okay. That's okay. But this is a great example of how when we've got this underlying need that we're not addressing, we might enter into conflict in a really different way. If this person is full and well-rested, maybe they're going to approach conflict in a bit of a different way than just saying, I'm right, my way or the highway. If we notice these things, how much different would our conflicts be? Or how much more different? So, why should we care? Why should we care about conflict and our needs? I think it's important for us to understand conflict as people of peace and people who follow Jesus. In Matthew 5, Jesus is speaking to a large crowd in the Sermon on the Mount. Throughout this chapter, Jesus is speaking to current issues within different communities, like dealing with anger and responding to the law. He's talking about managing different dynamics within different relationships. And by verse 38, he gets to this. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. So, when we're thinking about conflict, does this mean we're not supposed to address when someone has hurt us? Does Jesus want us to be a doormat? No. Jesus was speaking to a very contextual common practice that was practiced in the culture of the day. So to help us understand this, we need to understand a few other key pieces of this context. So first, hands were used for specific things in this time. So your right hand, normally people's dominant hand, used for things like eating, touching other people, this is your clean hand. Your left hand is used for more unclean daily tasks. So you're not going to be touching other people with this hand. So, we can safely assume that the person that Jesus is talking about, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, they're probably going to use their right hand to touch you. Second, we need to understand what discipline looks like in this context. And so to demonstrate this, Micah is going to give me a hand. Thanks, Micah. So, In this context, let's say I'm the master employer person and Micah is a servant. So there's a clear power dynamic here. And if Micah has done something that's worth disciplining in this context, I might strike him on the right cheek. So if Micah turns his right cheek towards me, I'm going to have to, and I use my right hand, I'm going to have to use my backhand. This is a sign for discipline. So backhand was actually the way you discipline someone. But if Micah turns the other cheek, I now have to use my forehand. Who knew you'd be learning about fighting in a conflict resolution sermon? But I have to use my forehand, which actually was a symbol of balancing power. Hitting someone with your forehand was actually a symbol of equality. You weren't using this to discipline, but it was something that you would use among equals, people who were the same as you, had the same amount of power. Thanks, Micah. Yeah. So in this passage, Jesus was creatively calling people to shift power, to balance power. If you were striking them on the left cheek, it meant that you were equals. You were inviting that person to see you as an equal. In doing so, you could change the story. In this passage, Jesus doesn't stop there. He goes on to list several different examples of how folks in this context could balance power. In thinking about who we are as people of peace, I believe this is so important. I think we're ahead one there, Wazir. Yep, thank you. Awesome. So people who love God have arguments, just like everyone else. And as people of peace, we have the opportunity to argue well, to disagree well, to respond to the hurt and harm in the world and in our lives with care and with love. Many of us find it challenging to hold space for different perspectives. It takes a lot of energy to talk about different perspectives. And for good reason, we are wired to find spaces where we belong, where we feel valued, where we feel safe. And so stepping into a conversation with somebody who's different than us might feel unsafe and takes a lot more energy to encounter that person. Because conversations about different perspectives or wrongdoing tend to be difficult, we avoid them with justifications like, they won't listen, or we're too different, or talking about it will just make it worse. There are many stories about conflict and teaching about conflict in the Bible. One story that I've been thinking about lately is the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15. In this chapter, Jesus is telling several parables about being lost and being found. In the parable of the prodigal son, Jesus shares a story of a man with two sons. When the younger son says to his father, "I want to leave, so give me my inheritance and I'll go." He goes, he lives, and eventually spends all of his money. When he hits rock bottom and he's eating with pigs, he goes back to his father, who welcomes him with open arms and wants to celebrate his homecoming with a party. I'll read his brother's reaction in Luke 15, 25 to 32, and invite you to listen for the older brother's needs. Now, his elder son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has got him back safe and sound." Then the brother became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him, but he answered his father, "Listen, for all those years I've been working like a slave for you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you've never given me even a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your property, you killed the fatted calf for him." Then the father said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we have to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found." In this story, the father shows grace to both of his sons, both to the one who has returned who has taken advantage maybe and come back, and the one who is angry. When I read this, I believe that the older brother's foundational need here is recognition. He's been here for all this time, and he's worked so hard, and for what? How has the father celebrated him? Does that sound familiar in any situations in our own lives? Yeah. The beautiful thing about this parable is that we don't know if the older brother actually goes into the banquet. We don't know if the older brother will take the courageous step towards family healing, to offer grace to his younger brother. I kind of like not knowing. I like thinking about the way that his heart would truly need to transform from anger to grace to be able to enter the banquet with joy. Or would he storm in and tear the place down, making everybody feel incredibly uncomfortable and create a nearly irreparable damage in his family relationships? Perhaps in leaving the ending of this story open, Jesus actually gives us a choice. What could happen either way? How would you respond in this situation as the brother? Would you stew in your anger and let that take over you and build into blame and grudges? Or would you take the courageous step towards reconciliation and do the hard work of healing this important relationship? In his book, Reconcile, John Paul Lederach writes, "First and foremost, Jesus saw common humanity. Jesus taught us to extend grace to others by staying present with them, by focusing on everyone around him, not only the important people or the people who agreed with him, but Jesus had the capacity to see the person and to greet the divine in the other. The key to his full presence with people was his capacity to notice the humanity of others. He was attentive to and noticed the sacred quality of personhood. As people of peace, Jesus invites us to be present with each other and to understand that at our core, the thing that unites us is our shared humanity. When Jesus says, turn the other cheek, he invites us to see the humanity in ourselves and in others. If in this scenario of turning the other cheek, if we are the person who is doing the striking, and they turn their other cheek to us, if they call us out for our actions, we can offer grace by accepting the responsibility for our actions and acknowledge the harm that we've caused. Now, this isn't an open invitation to call out everything that we don't like about someone, but it is an invitation to show care for the other person by sharing how you've been hurt. Good conflict resolution is as much about the process as it is about the outcome. When we do so, when we do step courageously into conflict resolution, we must be kind. If we do bring things up, we should do so out of care. It should be motivated by care for the people around us and for ourselves. So we're not just going around naming things that we don't like, but we're motivated by grace, by care. So what can we do about it? William Ury writes, "From realistic hope springs action. From a place of understanding, knowing, having tools, realistic hope, we can step forward and spring into spaces, courageously spring into spaces where we can take action. We're creating a different conflict story, a new conflict story by doing so. Often we say, I'm not going to say anything or I'm not going to do anything because I don't want to make it worse. Spoiler alert, that's not always true. Sometimes when we don't say something, it doesn't not make it worse, if that makes sense. My hope for us over the next few weeks is that we can come to believe this, that this doesn't have to be true. With some tools in our back pocket, we can go into difficult conversations with the goal to better understand the people around us. And starting a tough conversation may feel like it's getting worse. And in some ways, it is. But it doesn't always feel good because we're bringing hurt to the surface, and that can be painful. But if we don't bring it to the surface, it's not going anywhere. And that hurt will stay with us and manifest in different ways. Because conflict is so dynamic and depends on each individual relationship and situation, we want to help over time to build a toolbox, because different situations may call for a different approach. We could give you one tool and help you get really good at it and focus and practice, and you'd be good to go. But you may need a few more tools. It would be like showing up to a construction site with one tool, like, let's say, a hammer. You know, there's one spot where a hammer's great, and you are crushing it. Like, look at you, people are walking by, and you're like, yep, this is the hammer, look at me go. Right? You're so skilled with this one tool. But when you go to different places around the site, you might need different tools. Maybe like a saw or a drill or a wrench. But if all you've got is that hammer, and you show up in those different spaces, you're not going to be as effective as you could be with one of those other tools. You might even cause more damage with your hammer than you would if you had a different tool. So our goal is to equip each other with different tools so that when we come to different situations, we have lots of tools that we can draw upon. So I want to leave you this morning with a few strategies for tough conversations. And these are some things that I do to practice, to get myself into a space where I can enter into a conversation with grace. So, number one, be curious. So often in conflict, I've already got my side of the story, and I already think I understand theirs. And sometimes we approach conversations in a more of a judgmental way, like, oh, classic Katie, of course she would say that, obviously, right? We go in thinking that we understand the other person. But if we shift that judgment to a space of curiosity, we might reframe the way we're thinking about it to think, I wonder why Katie's doing that. I was watching a show a couple weeks ago, and there were two friends who knew each other really well. And they were having an argument about something. And one of them said, oh, you always do that. The other replied, I never always do something, which I loved, because even though we know somebody deeply, closely, we're not always predictable as we think, and people around us might not always be motivated by the same things or have the same perspective as we think they do. And so by being more curious, it opens us up to not be stuck into thinking about people in the boxes that we've created for them. So trying to be curious, trying to shift from judgment to curiosity. Second, we can try to shift from our head to our heart. So kind of similar, shifting from that judgmental space of maybe overthinking things or thinking we've got it all figured out, or rational kind of why would they do this sort of thinking, moving into our heart. How do you approach difficult conversations? Are you tense? Are you anxious? Are you like really focused? I don't know. But so when I'm going into conversations like this, I'm often a little bit anxious, like a few butterflies in my tummy. And so I prayerfully repeat a phrase that will help me remember the core of who this person is. Human, just like me. Something that helps me remember that this person deserves to be heard and understood. So this could be going into a conversation thinking about something like, or focusing on something like, find the good in this person. Or, God loves them and so will I. And repeating that to myself. When I'm going into a difficult conversation with my team at work, I will write this on the top of my notes so that even when things are maybe getting a little bit more tense or escalating, I can refer back to it and see and remember to find the good in that person. Or to remember that God loves them just the way he loves me. It really helps me to stay present and to stay in my heart, a curious space, an open space, a gracious space, so that I'm not stuck in my head where I can be defensive and judgmental. The last thing, tell me more. One thing that can keep us from becoming defensive helps us and helps us truly understand the other person is to talk less. We already know our side of the story. It's important for us to invite the other person to tell their story without interrupting or to say, yeah, but we have to hear their story out in full before we share our story or our opinion or our ideas. In doing so, we're really telling the other person that their story matters, that their experience is just as important, as rich, and as true as ours is. It's a practical way that we can find our common humanity. I have a big distinction for you. This is about how we can become more aware of ourselves and taking steps towards changing our attitudes and our actions. This isn't about trying to change others. It's about trying to change ourselves so that when we breathe in grace, we can freely breathe it out. How are you feeling? Are you feeling maybe knots in your stomach, tension in your shoulders, lighter, relaxed? Becoming more self-aware and thinking about some of these things may evoke different emotions in you, so I invite you to notice that this morning and this week. Becoming more self-aware in how we respond to conflict is an important step in becoming more open to changing the story we've told about conflict. I encourage you this week to try out some of these steps in regular, low-stakes conversations. Like when you're talking to your kids about how their day was, or when you're talking to somebody at work who's maybe, like, you have a good relationship with. In everyday conversations, start trying these things out and notice how it changes the way you communicate and what you learn about people. And if finding the common humanity in others shifts your perspectives to not see others as adversaries, but as people simply being who God created them to be, just like you. Pray with me. Holy One, Creator of life, yours is the peace that passes all understanding. Whether the war is between countries, belief systems, varied upbringing, family members, or churches, finding common ground is one way to start. For all who are searching, may your peace bring hope. For all who are aching, may your peace bring relief. For all who are arguing, may your peace intercede. For all who are hating, may your peace cast out fear. May your love surround and envelop all who are living with conflict, all who have been devastated by conflict, and all who are perpetuating conflict. May your transforming love pervade the darkness. Amen.